Hi, everybody. Stuart here. Welcome to the iFormRx podcast, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care, community, and geriatric pharmacy practice. In today's episode, we are going to be discussing a complex patient case. Now, evidence, of course, from research studies is critically important to making well-informed decisions, but a great clinician must also consider patient-specific factors like prior response to therapy or adverse effects, values and preferences, beliefs about medication, as well as institutional factors such as formularies and product availability and insurance coverage and access to specialists and specialty services. And that's why we've been experimenting with an educational series we've been calling Complex Patient Cases. Each case is loosely based on a real patient, but of course we don't share any protected health information during this podcast. The essential features and facts of the case will be described by an ambulatory care pharmacy practice resident and their preceptor. And we've invited a panel of experts to discuss the case with us. So today's complex patient case was developed by Dr. Jillian Cerullo, a PGY2 ambulatory care pharmacy resident, and Dr. Michelle Gauvin, a clinical pharmacy specialist with Lifespans Rhode Island Hospital in Providence, Rhode Island. And the case, as you'll soon learn, involves an older woman referred to the ambulatory care pharmacist for diabetes management. So Jillian, Michelle, thanks for developing this very interesting case.
Hi, Stuart. Thank you for having us. We're looking forward to discussing the case with you.
Yes, thank you for having us. Happy to be here.
So, Jillian, Michelle, it's great to have you both here as first-time contributors, so welcome. Our expert panelists today are Dr. Jennifer Trio and Dr. Joshua Newmiller. Jen and Josh are two colleagues I've had the honor of working with for many years and are longtime contributors to iFormRx. Dr. Trio is a professor of pharmacy practice and recently accepted the position of Associate Dean for Education at the University of Colorado Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. And Dr. Newmiller is professor of pharmacotherapy at Washington State University in Spokane, Washington. As some of our listeners probably know, Dr. Newmiller was the chair of the American Diabetes Association's Professional Practice Committee, which is the committee that's responsible for reviewing and updating the standards of care, which are published each year in diabetes care. And he's currently a member of the ADA board. Both Jen and Josh are certified diabetes care and education specialists, and among many other credentials and accolades they have for working with people with diabetes, and they have lots of experience. So Jen and Josh, thanks for agreeing to be here today to discuss this case with us.
Thanks, Stuart. It's great to be here.
Yes, thanks, Stuart. Always a pleasure to be here with you.
So, Jillian and Michelle, why don't you get us started by introducing the case?
So, the clinic that Michelle and I practice at is a community health center in an urban area of Rhode Island where patients are seen for both primary care and specialty medicine. Our patient, T.S., is a 55-year-old woman of Northern European descent who was referred to our clinic by the primary care provider to our ambulatory care pharmacy services for diabetes management. The provider had concern because the patient was not responding to their oral therapy, and the provider had a suspicion that the patient had not been adherent to their diet or medication. TS was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in February of 2022, and at that time had an unintentional weight loss of 20 pounds. On diagnosis, the patient's A1C was 8.0, and diet and lifestyle changes were implemented at that time, as well as initiation and titration of metformin to 1 gram twice a day. The patient seemed to be tolerating that regimen well, and at the 3-month follow-up, their A1C had decreased to 7.0. Since this was still above our goal for the patient, empagliflozin was added to a regimen, but unfortunately, over the next year, her glycemic control slowly worsened despite titrating empagliflozin to optimal dosing and adding glipizide. At this time, she's presenting and admitting to experiencing polydipsia, polyuria, fatigue, and frustration about her glucose being elevated and above goal despite her best efforts. She's also complaining of symptoms of a raised itchy patches on her elbows. When I interviewed the patient, she states that she has been checking her blood glucose 3 times per week, with most of her readings ranging between 150 to 250. Her A1C today, 9.0. I was asking the patient if she had been adherent to her diet and medications, and she admitted that she was, and this was confirmed with the medication dispense report showing regular pickups of her antiglycemic medications. So I'm wondering what your initial thoughts are, and are there additional pieces of information that I should obtain or questions that I should ask?
Well, I think it's a really interesting case. I think when you were describing the case, some of my initial questions that came to mind were related to the initial diagnosis. I'd love to know a little bit more about the events that happened when she got diagnosed, what led up to it, if we had any prior A1C levels before her diagnosis, if she had been diagnosed with prediabetes. And then curious to know what diet changes she made initially to try to kind of find out if the good response she had was because of significant diet changes versus a good response to the medications.
So the patient had prediabetes prior to diagnosis and had been getting regular A1C checks. So before she presented with an A1C of 8.0, the 6 months prior, she had prediabetes and did not have an elevated A1C at that time. For her dietary changes that she made were to increase her protein intake and decrease her carbohydrate intake, and she admitted to working on that as well as smaller portion sizes.
Yeah, thanks so much, Julian. Some other things I would be curious about. Does she have any other medical conditions, any comorbidities that we should be considering as we discuss her case?
Yes. So she not only has type 2 diabetes, but also has a past medical history of asthma, psoriasis, hay fever, and CKD.
Can you tell us a little bit more about her CKD?
Yes. So let me just take a look. So today for her CKD, she did have a serum creatinine of 1.5 and an EGFR of 44 milliliters per minute, as well as a urine microalbumin to creatinine ratio of 10 milligrams per gram.
And do we know if she's had any prior lab values that were also abnormal, or is this somewhat new? Any history of albuminuria?
We don't really have any prior information available before getting these labs, so it's unclear whether or not she's had longstanding CKD.
I really appreciate that you looked into the medication taking aspects, and then in fact she is reporting taking her meds, and there are refill records really to back that up. And I believe you said she, you know, responded well to the metformin. Has she responded well to her other glucose lowering therapies, the SGLT2 inhibitor and the glipizide? Has she had any issues with hypoglycemia, anything along those lines with those other meds?
She has not been reporting any episodes of hypoglycemia, but has also not had any A1C lowering, even with titration of the new addition of the SGLT2 or glipizide in the most recent months.
Could you also just run through the medications that she's taking?
Yeah, absolutely. So currently on her medication list is albuterol, which she takes as needed for her asthma. She has a betamethasone ointment, which she uses 1 to 2 times a day for her psoriasis. She also has cetirizine, a 10 milligram tablet she uses as needed for hay fever, ibuprofen 400 milligrams as needed, metformin 500 milligrams, extended release tablets. She takes 2 tablets twice a day. Empagliflozin 25 milligram tablets, 1 tablet once a day, and glipizide 5 milligram tablets, 1 tablet once a day.
With that history, I just wonder, do you happen to know if she's had bursts of systemic steroids in the past?
Yes. In the past for her psoriasis, she has been on systemic steroids, but she is not currently requiring systemic steroids.
That is interesting that she has psoriasis and some of these other issues. Do you happen to know if she has family history of diabetes or autoimmune disorders?
Yeah, so her mother had a history of type 1 diabetes, and her father had a history of ulcerative colitis.
And do we have any additional labs just in terms of her current weight, blood pressure, anything like that that might be helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. So this patient weighed 73 kilograms. Her blood pressure was 120 over 80 with a pulse of 68, respiratory rate 14. Her temperature was 36.9 degrees Celsius. Her height is 175 centimeters with a BMI of 23.8.
And I know you said she checks her blood sugar on occasion. Have you had a chance to look at her overall glycemic profile? Are there any specific trends, or is she just hyperglycemic all the time as far as we know?
Unfortunately, when she came into my clinic, she did not bring a list of her blood glucose readings, but reported from memory that they typically range between 150 to 250.
Are those typically first thing in the morning, or does she test at other times?
She tests first thing in the morning.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And then has she mentioned what the nature of her pain is and why she's taking the ibuprofen? Has that come up at all?
Today, she didn't report any pain. I'm not sure if there's another indication for her ibuprofen. She didn't report that she was experiencing any pain other than discomfort from her psoriasis at this time.
Yeah, thanks, Jillian. I think there are some interesting aspects to this case that really lead me to wonder if there is an autoimmune component. You mentioned that she does have the maternal and paternal autoimmune family history. She has psoriasis herself. As she presented with that initial weight loss, that it's a little more atypical than what we typically see in people with type 2 diabetes, and really pulling that in with her just general lack of response to non-insulin therapies thus far, I'm wondering if she may have something else going on here that isn't our classic type 2 diabetes presentation. And I wonder if you've done any labs looking at autoantibodies or possibly C-peptide.
Yeah, Josh, actually, we had the same inkling, and we did order GAD antibodies, and the results were positive, meaning it was abnormally high at 3.4 nanomoles per liter. And the patient's C-peptide was actually abnormally low at 0.34 nanograms per ml. So it does appear that the patient has latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, and we're wondering what the next step might be. Jillian and I already talked about discontinuing the glipizide, as it probably wouldn't have much effect. But we are curious as to whether you'd continue either the metformin or the empagliflozin, and what you'd add.
That's great that you ran those labs, and I think that really fits the picture we're hearing about this particular individual. I definitely agree with your initial thoughts to discontinue the sulfonylurea. Certainly, it doesn't appear that she's responding well to that agent, and it could very likely continue to or hasten her beta cell decline. I think one of the issues here, and I'll be curious to hear what Jen's thoughts are on this case, is there's not a lot of data, unfortunately, really with non-insulin therapies in the setting of LADA. And so we have to extrapolate to some of what we know from use of these agents in other populations. I think we do see rarely people use metformin in type 1 diabetes to help with the insulin sensitivity and things. So at least from my perspective, I wouldn't necessarily be real quick to cut the metformin in this instance. I think the SGLT2 inhibitor is one that could be debated, particularly given her comorbid chronic kidney disease. Of course, we don't have evidence in people with latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, but we know that it does protect the kidneys, certainly in people with type 2 diabetes, and many of those kidney outcome trials with SGLT2 inhibitors included people with non-diabetic CKD and showed benefit in those individuals. Of course, what we would be concerned about here in this individual would be potential for euglycemic diabetic ketoacidosis. So I think some of this would come down to whether or not we think she could safely manage that risk. And it sounds like she's been on this for some time and hasn't run into any issues, at least that we're aware aware of. So I think it's something we could consider. Jen, curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, Josh, I agree with your points. I think this is a really interesting situation with evidence-based medicine. Thinking about this patient from a glucose-lowering perspective and also from a kidney protection perspective. So based on her A1C, she definitely needs some glucose lowering. I don't think the SGLT2 inhibitors have great glucose lowering and very little evidence with type 1 diabetes. And then also just considering where this person's EGFR is, we know that once the EGFR falls below 45, you lose some of that glucose lowering ability. So I think from that perspective, I'm not hugely keen on continuing it in light of euglycemic DKA. The kidney perspective, though, I feel like I have to think about just a little bit because the person has chronic kidney disease. So thinking about whether or not this person would fit the patient population of the studies that have been conducted is really interesting. So mostly because you mentioned the person has blood pressure in the normal range, so there's no hypertension, this person has LADA, so not a person with type 2 diabetes, and doesn't have albuminuria. So has a reduced EGFR, but doesn't have albuminuria. So to fit this person in with the current evidence we have for kidney protection is a little challenging. I think this person wouldn't completely fit into any of those categories that we've seen benefit from the SGLT2 inhibitor. So with that in mind, I'm a little on the fence with that one. I agree getting rid of the sulfonylurea. And I also agree that keeping the metformin on is probably okay, but I think we have to think about additional therapy.
I was thinking along the same lines of Josh and Jen, where one of my concerns was this patient's renal function. Like we said, she does have stage 3 CKD, but her urine protein to creatinine ratio was quite good. Perhaps this was because she is taking that SGLT2 inhibitor. If we stopped the SGLT2 inhibitor, would you think about starting an ACE inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker? As we said, her blood pressure is already pretty low.
Well, that's a really great question and a great idea to wonder, maybe the patient doesn't have albuminuria right now because they are on an SGLT2 inhibitor. So that's a great thing to consider. In terms of an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, I'm also not convinced there's great evidence in this space. So a person that doesn't have hypertension and that does not have albuminuria, I don't think there's very strong evidence to support the use of an ACE inhibitor or an ARB.
Yeah, I agree, Jen. Years ago, we put everybody with diabetes on an ACE inhibitor and a statin, and now we know with some of the new evidence that has come out that there isn't necessarily benefit in all cases. And if we look at like the ADA KDIGO recommendations, they give clear recommendation to use RAS inhibitor in people with diabetic kidney disease who have hypertension and albuminuria. But in the absence of high blood pressure and albuminuria, there's really not any good evidence in somebody who kind of fits this picture that adding an ACE inhibitor, an ARB on, is going to help slow the progression of that kidney disease. And then we're, of course, worrying about hyperkalemia and some other issues. So I agree. I probably wouldn't reach for an ACE inhibitor ARB just right away. If we did decide to discontinue the SGLT2 inhibitor, if that was what we decided was best, and then monitor kidney function from there and make adjustments as needed based on what we see with the blood pressure and or albuminuria with that drug being discontinued.
Yeah, I think regardless whether we continue the SGLT2 inhibitor or discontinue it, at least in my practice, I would start insulin. I would start a low dose of basal insulin to try to provide some exogenous insulin to allow their beta cell function to be maintained as long as possible. I've had several patients in a similar situation where actually a quite low dose of basal insulin along with metformin or non-insulin products can help them kind of stay in that honeymoon phase for a little bit longer and maintain their own beta cell function for a little bit longer. And granted, the evidence in that space is not amazingly strong either. But I feel like in our clinical practice, that's probably what we would do. And then we'd probably have a good debate about whether or not we would continue the SGLT2 inhibitor for potential kidney benefit, even though the evidence might not be particularly suited for that person.
I totally agree, Jen. I guess going back to basics, we have somebody with an elevated A1C. We need to address that. And I would do the absolute same thing, get this person on basal insulin, get her educated on use of insulin self-injection, hypoglycemia education, and kind of address these other issues on a patient-centered basis and discussion.
So thank you, Jen and Josh. That's super helpful, and we really appreciate your perspective. One other issue that came up in this case is her psoriasis. In fact, it was actually the first thing that she talked about during our appointment. She's still complaining about these red itchy patches on her elbows despite using her betamethasone ointment for several weeks. Oral steroids are obviously going to impact her glycemic control, but I'm wondering if a short course would be okay or whether you would go for something else.
I know it's always tempting to really hone in on the diabetes aspects here, but we really have to listen to the individual. It sounds like this is particularly impactful on her daily life, and so we really have to address it. I think it's always certainly a risk-benefit situation here, as it always is, but I think I'd really be talking to the individual in terms of use of the steroids and what that's going to look like in terms of her blood glucose control, and really get a good handle on really how impactful this is on her day-to-day, and see if she's used other types of approaches like using emollients and other things to kind of help symptomatically. But I think using a short course steroid is an option, and I would just discuss that with her to see if her symptoms are severe enough that we want to do that. But for me, I'd want to be referring her, if we could, to a dermatologist to try and get more of a maintenance therapy on board so we could minimize systemic steroids that are really going to wreak havoc on her blood glucose control.
Josh, I'd have a similar approach. I would not be writing for a systemic steroid myself, but I would be referring her to dermatology or to her primary care provider. With that said, though, I have the luxury of being involved with interprofessional patient visits. And also, I know that our system, the derm office, is always backed up, very difficult to get into. So my suspicion is that the endocrinologist that I work with, who often very comfortably serves as a primary care provider for a lot of our patients, it wouldn't be surprising to me if he wrote for a prescription for a short course of steroids while the person was waiting to get in to see a dermatologist. I think my role would be the education piece, to talk about how steroids impact glucose and how medications or diet can be adjusted to try to address that, and how glucose monitoring can really be helpful at different times of the day, as opposed to just testing first thing in the morning when you're on steroid therapy.
Before I share the plan with a patient today, is there anything else I should be considering or doing?
I guess I'll just add one more thing. I know you said she was adherent to diet therapy. I think that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So that's always something that I'm very interested in exploring a little bit more. What exactly does that mean to that patient? How many carbohydrates are they consuming? What does their diet look like? That's going to have a huge impact on glucose control, also on kidney protection. So I would dive in a little bit more in terms of diet. I say that a lot because the patients that I've seen that have latent autoimmune diabetes oftentimes try to manage it with drastic diet changes because their oral medications are not working. So you get the impression sometimes that the oral medications might be having an impact on A1C. And when you dig a little deeper, you realize they have cut out carbs completely just to try to maintain their glucose control. So I would just try to get a little bit more information about what being adherent to a good diet means to this person.
Yeah, and I know we talked a lot about the kidney disease. I think it would be important to follow up in the near future just to see what the EGFR is doing, because that might have some impacts on our medication use. You know, she's right on the bubble there with the metformin dose being at 44 on the EGFR. So we might want to decrease the metformin dose to keep her safe. The other thing I would want to look into is, does she really need to be taking ibuprofen? Again, that's going to be potentially damaging to the kidneys. That could be a really easy thing we can do for kidney protection in her. And if she does need some pain relief, maybe looking at acetaminophen or another alternative. Of course, in all our people with diabetes, making sure they're current and up to date on all their regular immunizations, flu, COVID, Zoster, Pneumovax, et cetera. And then making sure she's getting in for dilated eye exam and looking at other risk factors to minimize risk of complications. To go back to the kidney disease quickly, if we look at some of the guidelines, considering putting her on a statin, guidelines would say type 1 or type 2, or even in the case of LADA, I think would be applicable that they be on statin therapy for cardiovascular risk reduction with chronic kidney disease. And then just in general, as you're already doing in your practice, just making sure we're reinforcing self-management education, especially if we do start her on insulin, make sure she's well-educated and equipped to manage that appropriately.
Well, Jillian, Michelle, Josh, Jen, this has been a really terrific conversation, and I want to thank all of you for participating in today's podcast. And I'm wondering what our listeners might do in a case like this. Would they do something different? You can weigh in on this case by posting a comment on the iFormerX website, and only iFormerX members can actually post comments and use the interactive features. And if you're not already a member of iFormerX, it's pretty easy to sign up, and it's free. You just go to our website, click on the Join Now in the upper navigation bar. And of course, it's free to professionals and aspiring health professionals. If you are a board-certified geriatric pharmacist and want to earn recertification credit for listening to this podcast, you actually can. We've partnered with the American Pharmacists Association to help produce their literature evaluation and evidence-based practice series. You can learn more about APHA's board prep and recertification programs by clicking on the link that's at the bottom of the written case study on our website. And lastly, before I sign off today, I want to thank Madison Yates. She's a clinical pharmacy specialist at Cone Health in Greensboro, North Carolina, and she's been our Instagram guru. Madison joined our advisory board this past year and suggested that we might be able to reach a wider audience if we started posting information about our commentaries and podcasts on Instagram. And frankly, I don't know that much about Instagram, but once I gave her the green light, she's been posting every 2 weeks about the new content that we have available on our website. And the number of people applying for new membership has definitely increased ever since. So thank you, Madison, for being so dedicated to our mission and helping us reach new audiences. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.